prayer.
Don't be afraid to explore. Without exploration, there are no discoveries. Don't be afraid of partial solutions. Without the tentative, there is no accomplishment. Indecision and procrastination are corrosive habits. Those who wait for every little thing to be perfect before they embark on a project, or who dislike the compromise of a partial solution, are among the least happy. Ideal circumstances are seldom given to anyone for an undertaking. Instead, there is uncertainty in every situation. The wise are those who can wrest great advantage from the circumstances opaque to everyone else. Wanting everything in life to be perfect before you take action is like wanting to reach a destination without travel. For those who follow spirit, travel is every bit as important as the destination, one step after another. That is still central to the wisdom of spirit. Every day passes whether you participate or not. If you are not careful, years will go by, and you will only have regrets. If you cannot solve a problem all at once, at least make a stab at it. Reduce your problems into smaller, more manageable packages, and you can make measurable progress towards achievement. If you wait for everything to be perfect according to your own preconceived plans, then you may well wait forever. If you go out and work with the current of your life, you may find that success comes from building upon small things.
For the night stuff, I can't remember. Alright. So now we're at this process of finding out the spiritual life is not a theory. That it has to be lived. And that statement is made at the end of the ninth step on page, 83. And between pages 76 and 83, they discuss the process of making amends. And they also explain to us why it is that we are undergoing this phase of development. And the reason they give us is to be of maximum service to God and those about us. I believe that's on the top of page 77. And then somewhere on page 76, they talk about, remember, you agreed at the beginning that you were willing to go to any length for victory over alcoholism and or drug addiction. And then they go through and they talk about making amends to people that we don't like, our enemies, business acquaintances. They talk about creditors. They talk about criminal offenses. They talk about amends that involve other people. They talk about, is that it? Being unfaithful, and they have a discussion about that. And then they come up to the part that we hear in the meetings all the time, the ninth step promises. And I just don't like it, and this is just Tarek's personal opinion, when they refer to the ninth step promises as the promises. What I've watched over the years, and I heard a guy say it like this, and so this is not original, but I understood it when I heard it, is that many people work the promises and they wait for the steps to come true. Yeah. And so it says we'll be amazed before we're halfway through. Well, halfway through what? What do you guys think they're talking about? Making amends. Before we're halfway through making amends, we'll be amazed. And then, I mean, I was talking to someone at the break, one of the breaks earlier, but I've sat in meetings and watched someone that, who I know without a shadow of a doubt has barely done any step work, but they're talking, they're raving about how these promises are coming true. I wish I could say it's only happened a handful of times, but it does. So these promises happen as a result of being willing to go to any length for victory over alcoholism and addiction. This is how we restore. Restoring relationships is part of the spiritual realm. Remember earlier we talked about being resentful and being shut off from the sunlight of the Spirit? Where if you've been ripping and running for 10, 15, 20 years, you probably got a lot of people that you've harmed along the way. And the vision that I have in my mind around this idea of making amends is I today am in a place where I can walk down any street in any city on this planet, and I'm not going to see an individual walking towards me that's going to cause me to change my behavior or go across the street or hide in any way. Even if I haven't made amends to them, I have approached them at some point and acknowledged my willingness to make the amends, and they chose not to contact me or told me they didn't want to meet. That's freedom. And then there's this idea of practicing steps 10 and 11 with unfinished amends versus finished amends. You know, one of the things that pulls us out of the present moment is the past, because we're constantly ruminating in a very narcissistic way. Done things differently. And part of making corrective measures and doing things differently is restoring these relationships. And one of the things that happens is you can overlay them with the bedevilments on page 52. Like the very first one is we're having trouble with personal relationships. Well, guess what happens when you're halfway through making amends? You lose interest in selfish things and you gain interest in your fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. That affects your relationships. They tend to become more balanced. You're not constantly taking. There's an equilibrium that's attained in that. And when that happens, we don't feel separated. We're constantly feeling connection everywhere we turn when we've restored these relationships. Because a lot of these amends have to do with people that we see on a regular basis, called the family. But, side note, the family amends are emotional and they create a lot of tears and there's a lot of harm that's been done. Most fear. The most fear is when I had to look somebody up that I robbed 10 years ago and I had to find them to make amends. You think there's more fear associated with that one than sitting down with my mom and dad? Absolutely. So what I've seen over the years is a lot of people, they get to step 8 and 9. They make amends to the immediate family, maybe some extended family, maybe the most recent employer, maybe some close friends, and then they stop. Because you will get some relief. But one thing about relief, it's temporary. The freedom that's accessible in this program can be permanent in a lot of ways. Now, we're going to struggle along the way because that's part of being human. But I've been free in one way or another the entire time I've been here. I've struggled, but I've been free. I can't control my emotional natures. I will comprehend the word serenity and I will know peace. I was a prey to misery and depression. My whole attitude and outlook. I couldn't make a living. Fear of people and economic insecurity has left me. We had a feeling of uselessness. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We were full of fear. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We were unhappy. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. That's what is attainable if you perform the action of the eighth step, which is making the list and approaching to set the appointment. So this process, my sponsor held my hand through the entire process. And if you want to look at it that way, step eight as well. So my sponsor holds my hand, but when I went to make these amends, no, my sponsor was not going with me to make the amends. It was just me and God. The evolution of this spiritual basis of life that's outlined in the 12 steps takes place in the form of a willingness that happens because of our first step experience. That willingness is then set against the decision to take action. So we make a decision, we take some actions, we get some results. And then what was willingness has now become belief that the process works if you stick around long enough. And then what happens is you go back to the beginning and you repeat. So now you're willing, you believe, you make a decision, you take some actions, you get some more results. What happens, what started with willingness goes into belief, turns into faith, and turns into trust eventually. And that process is part of the ultimate surrender, which I call steps 8 and 9, or the ultimate surrender in this program. Because that's when you're going to find out how big God is in your life. Because, I mean, let's be honest here. I mean, if the living the way of life described the alcoholics and addicts live, what ends up happening is we are tornadoes roaring through the lives of others. We got a lot to clean up. I got a phone call a couple years ago from a guy who got my number from somebody. And he had been sober for, I forget how long, it was multiple years. And he had relapsed. And he was in his late 30s. And I started, so when someone comes to me and they've relapsed, I'm going to have a conversation with them. And so what I'm going to do is, how many meetings were you going to? Did you have a consistent prayer and meditation life? Were you sponsoring guys? What steps were they on? You know, what did that look like? When you first got sober, you had this 8-step list. How many people were on it? And how many of those amends did you make? And he wasn't doing step 12, and his 11th step didn't have any meditation. And then we get to making the amends, and he goes to me, and he got sober. He was in his late 30s, and I think he got sober around 33, 34. I got sober at 31, and so I started ripping and running when I was 18, right? Started using when I was 14 or 15, alcohol and weed, but like the hardcore drugs came in like immediately around 18, and between 18 and 19. And then I'd lived that way of life for 12, 13 years. I harmed a lot of people, not to mention the people that I'd already harmed prior to that just due to selfish and inconsiderate habits. And so he told me that he only had, I can't remember, it was like 10 or 12 amends on his first 8-step list. And I was like, and that's when I was like, how old were you? And I said, were you an addict or alcoholic? And he was an addict. And I was like, there's no way on God's green earth that you got sober at 34 and you were an addict, ripping and running, and only harmed 10 or 12 people. I just don't buy it. All right. And so I started talking to him. I was like, look, let's go back through high school. Did you go through all your college acquaintances? Did you go through every job you've ever had? Your immediate family, your extended family, all the circles of people that you partied with, and all the drug dealers that you interacted with, and all of these people, and you're telling me you only come up with 10 or 12 amends. And guess where those 10 or 12 amends came from? The family. But this guy had a hard time on the phone. I had this conversation with him. We hung up the phone. I never heard from him again. I'm just not going to buy it. But I've seen and heard of a lot of 8-step lists that are comprised mainly of family and maybe a few sprinklings outside, but we don't go in depth. And so what I'd like to do is like whenever I get to talk about amends, there's 8 amends on my list here that I want to talk about, and these are just because they're the ones that created significant change in me. And I'm going to try to be short here. My dad is the first one, and he's the only one out of the 8 that's family. And my dad was important because when I went to make amends to my dad and realized I had become him, and when I asked him what I could do to make it right, You know, he said, I just want you to be happy, and I want you to spend time with me. And so I started taking my dad to dinner and a movie almost every Sunday. And this was in 2008 that we started. And in 2016, my father was diagnosed with liver cancer. Now, his death certificate says liver cancer, but it should be alcoholism in my book. So I became his primary caregiver. And, you know, God bless my mom and my stepdad. They allowed me to take care of my dad. They have like a finished in-law suite with a kitchen and like two bathrooms, bedrooms, all that stuff. And I was down there, and my stepdad changed my dad's diapers with me. And I remember I fell apart the first time I had to do that. And I'm the one administering all of the medication, the Dilaudid, morphine. I remember crushing up all the pills and filling up the syringe. And the palliative care nurses were not allowed to administer. They were just there, you know, they were there as oversight until my dad passed away. And I remember the nurse turned to me. She goes, "Damn, you're good at that." I was like, "Yeah, I've had a lot of practice." But there's no like, I mean, the 10-step promises are true. 10-step promises are true. And so I got to take care of my dad. And that was part of like me completing that amends, I think, in a way for me. It wasn't a living amends, but my responsibility was, I had music playing for him. I would sit next to his bed and meditate, and I had my prayer beads out, and I would read scriptures while I was sitting next to his bed, and I would rub his head, and I'd whisper in his ears that, you know, we're good, we're complete, you can move on whenever you want to. And eventually he moves on, but in the process of all of this, my brother is coming, and my brother and I have been estranged for many years. And one of the things I did to my brother, and I'm going to wrap this back into my dad. My brother, my brother and I were in the game, and he used to, we called it give me something on the cuff on the front, and he'd give me like 4, 5, 6 ounces of coke and super cheap, and I'm supposed to sell them. And I was smoking. And so I would disappear, and I'm like disappearing with a lot of money that belongs to my brother. And my brother wouldn't answer my phone. So my own brother has to come into my house and threaten. Imagine putting your own brother in this situation. I made amends to my brother, but you know, some of these amends that we make, we do our best to restore the relationship, but my brother and I had never been super close. So I don't know if that relationship will ever be whole. So we have that experience. I make the amends to my brother. My dad is passing away. My brother and I are estranged at the time. We're not talking. And when my brother comes to spend time with my dad and my brother are estranged. My brother at this point is just coming out of obligation. And I leave. And then when I return, he leaves. And the Wednesday night before my dad passed away, the nurses called us over, and this was my night off. And so we come back, it's like 2 a.m, and we're both holding my dad's arms. It's the last time my dad like really looked at us and knew we were there, and he smiled. And my brother just broke down because there's years and years of regret between both of them. And something in me, the ice around my heart. And I saw him break down 2 more times over the next 3 days, and we started spending time there at the same time with my dad. On Saturday afternoon, I come over, and my dad's not doing well. And this whole time, my mom's been like, "When you whisper in his ear, you should tell him you're going to take care of your brother." And I would turn to my mom and say, "Look, I can't make a commitment and not keep it. I just don't know if I have what it takes to take care of my brother, because he and I are just – we're so different, and we're so at butting heads most of the time." But this intuitive like thought, like the voice of what I call God, was kept telling me that I needed to do it, but I would resist. There was something in me resisting it and resisting. But that afternoon, there was no resistance. And I think this is only accessible because I have a consistent prayer and meditation life. I looked into my dad's eyes, and I leaned over, and I whispered, and I said, I'll take care of Chad, and I'll take care of Mom. We're good. And he looked up and took his last breath, and he was gone. And of course, my mom freaked out. Like, you know, it was like she knew it had something to do with my brother. the nurses, you know, they had been telling us that there was something he was waiting on. And without making the amends to my dad, that would not have been an experience that I was going to have. I restored that relationship even though I used to blame my dad for everything that happened to me in my life. And I wish I could report to you that my dad got sober, but he never did. You know? But I had a relationship, and I have absolutely no regrets about that. I showed up for my dad, and we developed a really good relationship. I learned a lot from my dad over those 10 years. And I cherish that experience, but if I had not made amends, it wouldn't have been accessible. So I slept with my best friend's fiance back in 2003. And a lot of people in our society, in our culture, in our ways of thinking, you sleep with your boy's fiance, chances are that relationship is shot. Never will be repaired. Not only did I do that, we were doing it behind everyone's back, and then a couple of our friends found out about it because it went on for a while. And they came to us and said we'd put them in a horrible spot, and that if we didn't tell him, they were going to tell him. And so we put a lot of attention. I had to make amends to everyone that was affected by this thing. And I was able to make amends to him. The reason I tell this story, I made amends to him in the first year, maybe year and a half of my recovery. And we started hanging out, and we started going to concerts again, and that relationship was restored. But the day I knew the relationship was restored is he gave me a gift. He had gotten this rock, really cool rock that he'd found at a lake or on a river, and he had it wrapped so it was a pendant. And he gave it to me, and he's like, "I love you, brother." And in 2010, we went to a retreat at a monastery, and the facilitator had sent an email to everybody and said, you know, bring an artifact that means has a significant meaning to you. And that's what I took to the retreat. And at the beginning of the retreat, we all got to stand up front and share the story